Hi, great. Welcome to the session on climate change adaption. We're going to focus on funding issues, and we're particularly going to focus on adaption from the viewpoint of preparing for the physical changes due to climate change, with particular emphasis on preparing for natural hazards, natural disasters such as tropical cyclone, flood, and others. So to introduce my esteemed panel, I have Kelly Christodoulou, who is from the Environmental, Social and Governance Investments area at Australian Super. Australian Super is one of the largest pension funds in Australia, with $110 billion funds under management. Doug Berg, at the end, is General Manager, Operations of the VMIA, Victorian Managed Insurance Authority, and has a long career in both insurance and reinsurance. Kate McKenzie is Head of Finance and Investment at the Climate Institute, an independent, non-partisan research and communications group, and she's written and co-authored a number of excellent papers on climate change adaption. And finally, John Harwood, who has over 12 years of experience in the general insurance field at Suncorp, and his current role is Consumer Product Solutions Manager, supporting the consumer insurance brand at Suncorp. So I'm first going to hand over to Kelly, who's going to give us a little background on why people in investments care about climate change adaption and how they're looking at the funding issues.
Thank you. Australia's climate is changing. We've all seen and heard the evidence of this. It's in the press. This will impact both us locally and globally, and as investors, this impacts us through our investment returns. At Australian Super, we have been integrating environmental, social and corporate governance issues, those so-called non-financial issues that can impact financial performance, since about 2008. And in terms of climate change, we have been recognised for our efforts. Recently, we were ranked the 13th pension fund globally by the Asset Owners Disclosure Project on how we consider and integrate climate change. Now, my name is Kelly. As we heard earlier, I have a rather long surname, which was said correctly as Christodoulou. And I also, just for the fun of it, have an even longer title. So it is the Environmental, Social and Governance Manager of Investments at Australian Super. If you have a longer surname and title than me, find me later and, you know, we'll have a drink together or something. I should actually also disclose that I am not an actuary. So, Australian Super is one of the largest super funds in Australia, with $110 billion under assets under management. We are also one of the 50th largest global pension funds. We have over 2.1 million Australians who actively contribute their part of their income into us. Please meet Sam. Sam is a member that joined us recently. And looking around this room now, I would have to say he is younger than any one of us sitting here. Just a guess, but he is 18 years old, and he could be with us up until retirement. That is a long time. We are fiduciary responsibility. We are fiduciary investors. We are responsible for Sam's retirement income. That is a huge responsibility to place on anyone. So as I mentioned, we've been integrating environmental, social and corporate governance factors since 2008, and up on the screen is the framework on how we make our decisions and our actions. The first pillar is the ESG integration pillar, and that essentially aims to improve Sam's retirement outcomes through the consideration, integration and valuation of ESG issues. The stewardship pillar aims to improve investment outcomes through the exercise of our rights and responsibilities as owners of companies and assets. And the third pillar is our choice pillar. So you've met Sam. Sam doesn't want his retirement money to be invested in coal companies and people of his generation, younger than us. They want their retirement, they want their pensions not to be invested in tobacco, coal, oil and gas companies. So we understand this and we provide an option so that Sam can put his money into that. And climate change fits across all the frameworks, all the pillars. When we first started looking at climate change, we firstly decided that apart from not being an actuary, I'm also not a climate scientist. No one at Australian Super is a climate scientist. So we accept what 97% of the science is telling us. Now, for an investor, this level of acceptance is enough to make it a real issue. So it really doesn't matter if you believe in climate change or not, given that policymakers, businesses, society believe it's true, and they're acting that way. This means that we also need to act, and you also need to act. So just thinking from a purely investment issue, for us, the investment considerations of climate change can be summed up in sort of two high-level risks, the transition risk and the physical impact risk. The transition risk is really the constraints of fossil fuel consumptions, either through policy, cap and trade, carbon tax, product standards, or technology disruptions, developments, and the falling cost of renewables. So that's a transition risk. The other risk is a physical impact risk, which is damages on the assets due to changing weather patterns. Now, for us, when we think about climate change, the issue that always comes back to me is timing. Yes, we understand it's coming, but we don't know when. So I always say that uncertainty is not an excuse to do nothing. This transition, we think this climate change is a transition, it's a journey. I hate that word journey, but it's a journey. It won't happen overnight, but it will happen. So just looking at one of the case studies on our infrastructure assets of physical impact, we realised that for the physical impact risks, on one of our asset class, which is infrastructure, we realise that the impact will very much depend on the age, the type, and the location of the asset. We have engaged, or we did engage, an engineering firm to identify and assess the risks of a changing climate and its impact to our infrastructure assets and determine an adaptation plan for us. So we chose four different types of assets located in different locations in Australia, and three of them are up on screen now. You may recognise one or two of them. We chose two scenarios to the year 2030 and again 2070. And we had to think this far in advance because of members like Sam. So eventually what we found was that even though climate change may damage the physical infrastructure assets, the assets themselves, the real risks to us as an investor actually relates on how the impacts may jeopardise the asset's ability to meet its operational services, therefore how we generate a cash flow from that asset and therefore the impact to our members' return. So that's how we think of it in terms of cash flow. And the outcome of this, once we went through and developed an adaptation plan for these assets, in summary, we found that the most effective way to manage climate change risks to our infrastructure assets was to integrate it through its operational asset management program, basically through the OPEX. Now, incremental changes here and there to hopefully protect what will come. Now, that brings me to the end of my quick slideshow. I understand we're having questions at the end, so I'm happy to pass back to Alfred now. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks. John, did you just want to jump up in? He's going to give us the background view of why insurance clerks care about climate change, and in particular, give us some examples of how they're funding adaptation.
Thanks, Alison. So I'm from Suncorp, and in the consumer portfolio, which is home and motor insurance, essentially. So why is climate change important for insurers? So I'm going to hark back to what Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, said 2 years ago. So he pointed it out very clearly, and it's quite simple to call it out. So the first thing is risk to the physical environment. So that's all your natural hazard disasters. So in a world of more extreme climates, you're going to get more extreme natural hazard events. So more bushfires, more extreme cyclones, more flooding, etc. So that's clearly an obvious risk for us as an insurer or the insurance industry. The second one is that transition risk that Kate was talking to earlier. Now, I won't go into too much more detail there because I know some of our other panellists might be going into that in a bit more detail. And the third one is a liability risk. So that's the risk that directors and officers get sued essentially for ignoring the risks, the climate risks to their businesses. So this one for insurers, I think it's quite understated, and it for me it's actually more of a clear and present danger because there are companies in the US right now that are getting sued because the directors are not taking the right actions to acknowledge the financial risk due to climate change in their companies. So where it affects us as insurers, obviously we have our own directors as well. In addition to that, we have a lot of directors and officers professional indemnity coverage. So if those insureds on our book get sued, then we're going to be the ones paying that out unless we take action there. So they're the three main reasons why insurers care about climate change. It's the risk to the physical environment, transition risks as we move to a carbon-constrained economy and the resulting impacts on investments, and also the liability risks. Now, what I wanted to share with you is some of the things we've done in the adaption space within Suncorp. So when I refer to mitigation, I'm not referring to mitigation of carbon emissions. We've certainly done things in that space as well, such as reducing our floor space footprint and other things like that. What I will be focusing on is how we've mitigated against the natural hazard risk. So the first one we have up there is an example around levees in Roma. So shortly after the floods of 2011, the Queensland floods, we had found that since 2005 we had over $500 million in claims just from the one town, and we made a very tough decision at that time to stop underwriting business there as a way to get local government to put the appropriate mitigations in place. So and we said, look, the moment there's a levy put in place, we will certainly start writing business again, and we will also reflect the new risk there. So thankfully the government did that at a cost of around $20 million. And the great story was that we were able to drop premiums for the most exposed properties, in some cases up to 90% of what they were previously. So I think that was a great story. And it created the adaptive capacity for people in that town. So if events or flooding events become more common or more extreme in the future, then that town now has the adaptive capacity to be able to cope with that. So the next example I'll get to in one sec before I've been told not to click because it'll go straight into the video. This one is the cyclone resilience benefits. So this is where we're incentivising customers who have done the appropriate adaption measures on their homes to make their homes more resilient to cyclone damage, because we can't stop the cyclone from happening, and Suncorp being a Queensland insurer, we can't pull out completely of Queensland. That's just not socially responsible. So the only thing we have to play with there is addressing the vulnerability of the housing stock there, of which there's a pretty significant risk. So now I can click.
Cyclones are a part of life in Northern Australia, and there are many homes that may be at risk. We won't ever be able to stop cyclones, but Suncorp Insurance is committed to helping Northern Australia become more cyclone resilient and making home insurance more accessible. This is why we've introduced our Cyclone Resilience Benefit for our home insurance customers. If you live in a cyclone-prone area in Northern Australia, you may be eligible to receive a premium reduction on our home insurance if your property has certain features and measures which can strengthen your home against cyclones. Our cyclone resilience questions are based on research with cyclone engineering experts at James Cook University, which found having a strong, resilient home can reduce the damage sustained during a major cyclone and the likelihood of making a claim. Just like a home with deadlocks is safer from theft, a stronger home is safer from cyclones. And we believe homeowners should be rewarded for this. We would like to know more about your home and how you prepare for cyclones. Things like roofs, doors, windows, roller doors, sheds, and general preparedness. Our cyclone resilience benefit takes these features and measures into account in calculating the home insurance premium. If eligible, you may receive a reduction to your premium compared to what you would otherwise have paid for Suncorp home insurance.
And that's it. Okay, the other thing that we've done very recently is offered resilience loans to eligible customers where we will give them a low-cost unsecured loan to do some of those upgrades that we were talking about before. So that's further incentivising customers to build that adaptive capacity. So that's pretty much my case studies. And I'll sit back down.
So I'm afraid the panelists are probably going to have to fight over the one microphone, but I thought it might be good. Doug, can you tell us how does government think about the climate change risks in your view, and what's the difference in particular between the investor and the insurer view?
Okay, thanks, Alison. Check 1, 2. Hello. Yes. Yes. I'll start by just with a little disclaimer. I work for a state government agency. And I'm not speaking on behalf of government. I can speak on behalf of the agency. It's possible that my views will align with those of government, but that will be a happy coincidence. And I might just start by taking that that government view. Victorian government has probably for the last 20 years taken a view of risk management. And they've done that in a number of ways. And I think if we look at climate change as a risk management exercise, I think that's probably a good way of considering government response. Firstly, the government has the Victorian Government Risk Management Framework, which rejoices under the acronym of VGRMF. It trips off the tongue after a while, I assure you. And that is saying to government and the various arms of government, the seven departments we have here in Victoria and the associated agencies, you guys are responsible for your risk management. However that risk arises, it might be physical risk, financial risk, or enterprise risk. The other way that the state of Victoria has dealt with risk is to set up the VMIA, and we've been around a bit over 20 years now, where the insurer of government assets, about 190 billion of assets have come under our watch, and we're also the risk management advisor to the state of Victoria. And finally, with specific reference to the climate change, yes, the state has the Victoria's Climate Change Adaptation Plan 2017 to 2020, fresh off the press. And for actuaries, this has got a lot of very interesting problems to solve. The government in the state budget of a couple of weeks ago has allocated $12.6 million. Do your Austin Powers impression at this point. So hop in for a share of that going forward into future years. Climate risk affects the state as the owner of assets. And as I said, of the 190 billion assets that the state is responsible for, these have a financial cost if you're going to repair or replace them. They also result, and this is the key for government, in economic and community disruption when the assets aren't working. So if you can't get across a bridge, that has significant effects in the community. It's also a provider of services, so the state runs a public health system and emergency services. Over time, as climate change comes to bear upon significant events, there'll be a gradually increasing strain on those services. And gradually increasing strain is expensive for governments to relieve. And of course there'll be shock overload, and you remember just something as simple as a big thunderstorm back in November, I think it was, created a huge increase, a spike in asthma attacks. It actually led to a number of deaths and completely overwhelmed emergency services. So you get a few more of those in a year, and you need to learn to, you need to adapt somehow to that. The other thing about the state is that if you've been following legal developments, when the state of Victoria had its bad bushfires back in February 2009, known as Black Saturday now, this resulted in a huge and expensive class action against initially the power company that was accused of starting the bushfire, but the state was joined in that. And the state of Victoria, like I'd say most states in Australia, normally don't legislate itself away from liability. Most states front up and are suable and do get sued. So if the state of Victoria is found wanting in delivery of any of those services, for whatever reason, because maybe it didn't plan for the fact that there could be a spike, then it will be sued. And we at BMIA issue public liability policies to the state departments and agencies. The state is also the expert provider of information, advice, authority to the community on climate change and climate change adaptation. So what's the right advice? And again, a liability issue arises there. And of course, as we see, politics intrudes, and there is often a conflict between what part of the government sees as economic development and another part of the government sees as keeping the community and the state's assets out of harm's way. Finally, there's the state as the manager of an economy in transition, and we've heard a bit about that from previous speakers. It would appear that the world economy is in transition from where it is at the moment to an economy that is not so based on basically digging fossilised carbon out of the ground. And what are the knock-on effects to other assets the state is running and its industries? And we can postulate that, but we don't know. And one thing we've seen with the advent of technology is you really don't know what the future holds. Certainly, the price of carbon, one would think, in a traditional economic model, will increase. State will be tempted, as all governments are, to pick winners. Other parts of the government will say, we'll let the market decide. We've seen a digital revolution. In fact, we're in the middle of it, and that's turning out pretty well. But what will the industrial revolution look like as a result of climate change? And absolutely, finally, the state is representing the community. And one thing I've learned in my short time in government, or at least in the public sector, is that, and when you think about it, it's true, governments exist because society wants them to. And so when you get a breakdown in community confidence, or in social cohesion, or in economic stability, then there will be direct costs to the state and as a result of that.
Okay. Thanks, Doug. That was gave us a very good feel for the different ways that government looks at it. Maybe a question for Kate, because one of the issues is always going to be that it's much more palatable to fund after the event has occurred. Everybody understands that, and you can, in fact, raise a tax, as we did for the Queensland floods, to pay for it. How do we actually convince people to fund beforehand? What do you see as the main challenges there, Kate?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. It is very hard to get people to pay up front, both private sector and really the public sector and as individuals, to mitigate against foreseeable impacts. It's probably some aspect of human nature that, you know, that we've all observed, I'm sure, in our work. Most of my research into adaptation has focused on the different actors in climate adaptation and has tried to kind of hone in on where the failures to arise evolve from. And what I've tended to focus on in particular is where incentives are absent or misaligned. So in order to have some kind of, you know, thoughtful and arguably kind of reasonable approach to investing in adaptation, you need to have a lot of different parts of society come together the way it currently works. You need governments of all levels. Insurers obviously have a really important role, but so do other financing organisations. The providers of finance, I should say, as opposed to insurers, including investors, but also banks. So currently, you know, it's very hard to argue that this is something that's been addressed to any degree that is reasonable, given the historical risk that we know that we face from natural disasters and catastrophes and extreme weather, let alone the increasing frequency and severity of some of these events. I think a few things that will change that one would be where the contingent liabilities become sort of crystallised and more recognised on government balance sheets. I'm not sure exactly how that might come about, but because governments, like any other organisation, are, you know, to some degree, not always incentivised to kind of think long term. Particularly, you know, we have a political system where, you know, you might have one government that's not, you know, they're not counting on being in power for more than a few years, perhaps. So there are things working against that kind of longer term planning. Doug mentioned that governments exist because societies want them to exist, and often, where there has been a good response and good efforts around adaptation, it's often been because the society, because people, you know, enough of the public are mobilised and recognised the risk that they were in, and they felt that risk. And I think actually John's example, I was just thinking, because I've heard the Roma example a few times, and it's really fantastic example of an insurer actually kind of doing something that really the government should have figured out on its own that it needed to do, but essentially, you know, the insurer was able to say, look, the risk is too high, and was able to kind of leverage pressure, I guess, political pressure via the public, by saying, you know, we can't insure you, it's too expensive, the risk is too high, and then that created that momentum for that upfront investment, which will then benefit the residents there, not just through lower insurance premiums and not just even through being able to get insurance, but also through presumably reduced risk of hazard to themselves and their property. So that had a public good, but, you know, there was an interesting sort of combination of things that had to happen, and really, you know, it's interesting that a private sector company had to kind of step in and crystallise that risk to get the local and state, it was local and state, wasn't it? I think it was state government kind of, to kind of finance that mitigation project. I think also, just quickly, I think as information about risk becomes more accessible, and there's a whole bunch of tools that are emerging. A lot of them are public, some of them are private, but are sort of made publicly available. So there's something called coastalrisk.com.au where you can just go in and run a little lever and see how sea level rise will affect where you live at different levels. So it's pretty limited. It just gives you average sea level rise, which, as probably some of you know, doesn't, you know, the risk from flooding is that's only one factor in that. But there are other things like there's something called NARCLIM. There's a new tool called CoastAdapt that's publicly funded through NCARF, which again, just give. There's just more. Increasingly, there's more resources and more sort of publicly available resources. And I think I think, or I like to think, it will be helpful when more and more individuals and companies can sort of see, you know, get that very visual sense or very sort of concrete sense of what their current risk is and how that risk will increase over time. Because as individuals, you know, we're pretty invested in, you know, the places where we live and work and go to school, and, you know, not just through the fact that, you know, we buy a house, but also, you know, we live in a community. So you know, I think that might change things. I think maybe ratings agencies putting pressure on government, you know, as bond issuers will change things, and some of them have already indicated that they're interested in that and they're looking at it.
So I guess before we jump to questions from the audience, I'd like to touch on resilience bonds, which are one of the new opportunities in this funding area. So the idea of a cat bond, where the premium paid goes down due to essentially adaption issues, such as building a flood levee, which would reduce flood risk. So this is something that, for instance, a city might choose to use, issuing the cat bond and then the premium reflecting that, so that they are encouraged and therefore undertake or indeed use the premium reduction to fund the levy. Kelly, I didn't let you know this question was coming, but is this something that you would buy as an investor?
So how we make investment decisions in terms of any type of asset, lots of instruments come to us, lots of different investment types come to us. We have to assess each specific investment based on our internal risk and return criteria. And as I mentioned, we have fiduciary responsibility. It's the financial outcome for Sam. So this is something, if it met with our risk return criteria for that specific asset class, yes, we would. But we are still waiting.
Okay, great. So you basically measure it up against others. Are there any other, I guess, new opportunities in the area of funding that anybody on the panel would like to mention? I know you have a lot of them. It's a question of who. Go on, John.
I can. Well, no, not. Well, there's the resilient bond idea, resilience bonds idea, which I can expand just a little bit on. So I think that's a really good opportunity to branch out just beyond the climate bonds or green bonds or social impact bonds that currently exist. It's certainly a bit of a play on that. And from an insurance perspective, if we're able to, if there's, you know, a pot of money that investors have put forward to then fund all these resilience infrastructure works, then there's clearly benefit to insurers because you're taking that risk off their balance sheet, as well as benefits for communities as well, because their risk is lower of the particular natural hazard that you're trying to mitigate against. And then, you know, from a from an investments perspective, it creates in a way a new asset class that is quite uncorrelated with existing investments. So I think that's certainly a good idea. They're certainly devil in the detail. And I think there's a lot of challenges out there for actuaries to get involved in this space as well, because how do you actually monetize the return that a resilience bond would have? Effectively, it's being able to look at that reduction in risk that you achieve once that resilience work's put in place. It's quite interesting.
Great. Thanks. Let's see if there's a couple of questions in the audience. I would ask if you want to get up and use the microphone. Come on, Elaine. You're always good for a question or two on this one.
Elaine Grace, Actuaries Institute. So I guess my question is especially to the superannuation industry on the investment side. I guess just when you're investing in these infrastructure assets, do you tend to like share the infrastructure asset with other superannuation funds, or do you tend to own it on your own? And how much do you think there is an increasing activism in this area? Because it becomes a very difficult thing when it's just a side product of those who actually are engaged and take it up, as opposed to becoming a mainstream that actually you as leaders with your fiduciary duty around what life that 20-year-old is going to have as opposed to just the income it's going to get from their pension, kind of in an all-encompassing. So I guess I'm just wondering, have you noticed a shift in that superannuation industry, and do you need to do it cooperatively with other funds, or can you do it on your own?
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely, the activism part. But firstly, to your first question, yes, we do tend to own assets with other pension funds or superannuation funds. So those assets that were up on screen, we would typically own between 5 to, say, 16%, so not be too significant. And so that helps. So, and also, we're quite lucky in Australia. I'm with an industry fund. We tend to get together and we talk about climate change issues. So this is one area of investments where we collectively share our knowledge versus the other side, where it's competition. And in terms of the activist side, this morning I came into work and I had about 25 emails from people asking me to vote on a particular resolution at the upcoming ExxonMobil AGM, you know, vote for a specific climate change resolution. So yes, that they somehow get hold of my email address and, yeah, they email me. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing society in general getting more more activist. They're more awake now, and they know that they can use their superannuation as a platform to share, or at least to tell us how they want to vote. So, yes, I also get a lot of the activists actually come in, you know, get up, market forces. We do meet with them regularly because we want to understand how they're thinking about climate change. You know, they're another source of knowledge. We may not agree with them all the time, but they're another source of information and knowledge to complete our picture of how the world is transitioning and thinking about climate change. Because as soon as society acts, businesses then act, and then government acts. So we need to be aware.
Sorry, are Australians super using it when they speak to their shareholders or when their company investments? Or are you using, have you ever voted on ExxonMobil?
Yes,
Are you using that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and that's the powerful thing. So with at Australian Super, we're a significant shareholder of about, I think we're coming up to about 30 ASX companies where we own over 5%. And that gives us a foot in the door and actually a seat at the table. So one of my roles is to engage with directors of ASX 200 companies, and we ask them, how are you preparing for climate change, physical impact risks, all that? And specifically now we're engaging on the TCFD recommendations for all mining materials, oil and gas companies. How are you going to start using and incorporating the scenarios, the 1.5 degree scenarios, the 2 degree scenarios? Tell us about that, and we want to see it up on your website. So it's a long process, but behind the scenes, yes, we're absolutely speaking to them.
Okay.
There was a story that I came across last week. The CEO of BlackRock, I think the biggest investment fund manager in the world, said around climate risk, look, we are patient, but we're not infinitely patient with the companies that they invest in. So it will get to a point where they'll start voting, using their power to start voting. Oh, they did already.
Yeah. Occidental Petroleum. It was just 2 weeks ago, they voted in favour of a climate risk disclosure resolution, and it was the first one. It's the first time they've ever done that, and yeah, they're the biggest asset manager in the world. So yeah, they're already starting it.
Yeah, okay. And just to add back to the insurance space. So this isn't happening currently, but we're the analogy being that in the home insurance space, we put a price signal on homes that are at high risk. So in the commercial insurance space, you could see where for D&O risk, we can put a price signal on to companies who are not adequately looking at the financial risk due to climate change, and we could do that as well. So that would put further pressure on the companies to do something about it.
I'm now going to ask, actually, Doug, what can actuaries do in this area? Where do you see the value that they can bring, the opportunities for actuaries?
Well, I was actually in another session this morning, and I looked at the logo of the Actuaries Institute, and it occurred to me that the interesting thing there is not the sigma sitting in the middle, because really any valuation actuary can sort of add and subtract. It's the delta that the sigma is sitting in. And climate change is about uncertainty, and the value that I think actuaries bring to business is their understanding of where uncertainty comes from and the ability, more importantly, to measure it. All of these bonds and monetizing them will only occur if you can translate the climate scientist into a measure of uncertainty, into a measure of mitigation, and then do the before and after sum. So I see lots of opportunity for actuaries, and in terms of the state of Victoria, there's a bunch of us sitting across the road in the office at the moment trying to work out how to ensure the economy of Victoria, and if we succeed in that, we'll be very popular with the Treasurer's Office.
And unfortunately with that, I think we might be out of time, is that right? As you can tell, we have a panel that's very passionate about this subject. So I hope you'd join with thanking our panelists, Kelly, John, Kate and Doug. Thank you very much.